The change over the Arctic sea is stunning. We've never ever seen such a large change before.
Satellite images taken this month show Arctic ice cover fell to the lowest level since scientists started collecting such information in 1978. Many experts believe that global warming is to blame for receding ice level.
The climate models are telling us that through the future, we're of course going to lose that Arctic sea ice cover as the climate begins to warm. What we're seeing today, though, is that we're 30 years ahead of schedule from what our models are telling us. So the Arctic is on this fast track.
In the summer of 2005, the Arctic ice drew back to reveal a record amount of Northern Ocean. The summer melt of 2007 was 23% bigger than that. We are losing the annual white reflective cover over the Arctic Sea. The whole climate system of the Earth could be affected. This is Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Today we'll try to find out why the summer ice is disappearing in the Arctic at a record rate, and what it means. Expert scientists were surprised and shocked at what happened in the Arctic last summer, and you should be too. Humans are already scheming to use the new Arctic Ocean. Oil and gas companies, the very same multinational corporations fat with profits from climate change-inducing products, are impatient to start drilling and extracting more fossil fuels from the far north. The whole shipping industry wants to cut across the Arctic from Asia to Europe, saving millions of gallons of fuel, but risking a semi-permanent smear of oil from even the smallest of accidents. Right now, there are supersized container ships and tankers too large to fit through the Panama Canal. They must go all the way around the stormy tip of South America to connect between Asia, the new location of the world's factories, and markets in the eastern United States and Europe. Going across the Arctic would cut 10,000 miles off that trip. Humans look north as the Ice Maiden raises her white skirts, her white skirts, her white skirts. The summer ice melt of 2007 created a new ocean surface over 1 million square miles, an area six times the state of California. In just 6 days of September, ice the size of Florida, 69,000 square miles of it, disappeared. That's almost 18 million hectares of new ocean. American science, censored and driven as we know by a denier White House, just look at the latest report from the Democrats, finds new sub-causes which are seldom linked to the forbidden words of climate change. For example, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has a new study saying the ice didn't melt, it just, well, it moved away. Published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters in early October, the research led by Son Yim employed a system of buoys and satellite imagery to show that heavy winds since the year 2000 drove older, thicker ice eastward out of the Arctic basin, right past Greenland. These heavy ice sheets developed over years left thinner ice, which melted much faster this past summer, they say. Another NASA study found that the thick ice, as measured in 1987, had dropped from 80% to 2% this spring. That may be due to a phenomenon known as the Arctic Oscillation. But surely the steadily rising average temperatures in the Arctic, which goes up way more than the global average as the climate shifts, is part of this picture. And where did these winds come from, and why did the ice move? As Andrew Revkin of the New York Times found in his October 2nd article, a check-in with scientists found that their theories were as unsettled as the ice itself. If we really knew what caused the record summer ice melt of 2007, someone might have predicted it, and no one did. In part, this comes from a lack of resources and interest in a financially sterile environment of the frozen north. The other problem, the Earth is changing so fast that our patient scientific measurements just can't keep up. One thing Revkin did find, scientists who previously argued for natural variability in the Arctic were stunned by the recent massive ice melt. A majority now feel climate change is at work. And the date when the Arctic Ocean will be all blue moves ever closer. An open ocean was once suggested for a future century. Now, some scientists, like Wieslaw Maslowski of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, suggest it could come as early as 2013, Others say 2030. We don't know, and this year's rapid ice melt shows just how much we don't know. The big melt of 2007 could be a convergence of many causes. That's usually the way in nature. There was a high-pressure system hovering overhead, which may have drawn warm winds from Siberia. The skies were unusually sunny during June and July. Increased water vapor may be a factor. Another team of American Arctic researchers, Dr. Maslowski in Monterey and Dr. Igor V. Palyakov at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, found that more warm water is entering the Arctic Ocean through the Bering Strait, that body of water between Alaska and Russia. Still more warm currents coming in from the Atlantic near Scandinavia. Again, this begs the question, why is the ocean warmer? And why have the currents changed? Not answered in official government-funded research, which always seems to lead to the conclusion that natural shifts are responsible, not human-made global warming, not our smokestacks and tailpipes, oh no. There are exceptions. Mark Cerise, as senior scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, admits natural factors are contributing, but, quote, the effects of greenhouse warming are now coming through loud and clear. We'll be hearing more from Mark Cerise later in this program as we bring you the highlights of a panel of Arctic experts reporting to a congressional committee at the end of November. James Hansen of NASA is another brave exception, defying government gag orders. Hansen told Reuters, quote, the reason so much of the Arctic ice went suddenly is that it is hitting a tipping point that we have been warning about for the past few years, end quote. The Potsdam Institute for the Climate Impact Research agrees with him. The Arctic ice system has already tipped, they say. Possible impacts, and we don't know yet, include changes to the Indian monsoon, a slowdown of the Gulf Stream, and more melting of the Siberian permafrost. Here is yet another European scientific institute saying the Arctic tipping point is behind us. Pal Prestlud of the Center for the International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo told Reuters in an article September 28th, quote, I'd say we are reaching a tipping point or are past it for the ice. There is a strong indication that there is an amplifying mechanism here, end quote. Another supporting detail, almost every climate model has predicted a growing Arctic ice melt as one of the impacts of climate change due to increased greenhouse gases. Scientists said it would happen as a key indicator that the big change is arriving. The problem is that these models underestimated the amount and timing of the big ice melt. Now it's here. The fact that a tipping point escaped all our study and computer modeling is very worrying. The same could be true for the time of the melt of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, those vast stores of water that could drown our coastal cities. All bets are off when it comes to how soon that could happen. Remember that sea ice melting does not lead to rising sea levels. That is counter to common sense until you think of ice cubes melting in your drink. They don't cause your glass to overflow as they melt because their weight had already been displaced the same amount of water. That's not true of the land ice sheets, but it's true of the open ocean ice sheets. The real impacts, though, are several. New flows of water could impact ocean currents, which are the largest single driver of our climate. Air currents are also changed, and the dark open ocean absorbs much more heat from the sun, leading to more ice melt, the positive feedback loop. Aboriginal people like the Inuit of northern Canada are seeing their lifestyles, developed over countless of thousands of years, wiped out. And without the ice buffer, some villages in Alaska are being pounded into the sea. Somewhere down the ladder of human worries, well, animals like polar bears will likely go extinct without the ice shelves for hunting. In early September 2007, the United States Geological Survey predicted that if ice declined at the current rate, two-thirds of the polar bears will be gone by 2050. As we'll hear later in the program, that's just one of the impacts of the new hot Arctic on the ecosphere. This one hot summer of 2007 had lasting impacts on the land species as well. Stay tuned for Canadian research on this year's sudden rearrangement of the northern landscape. We've been counting up various reasons why this ice melt occurred at all. Another amplifying factor is the black soot coming from out-of-control and unreported forest fires burning across northern Canada and Siberia. Please download our October 19th Radio EcoShock show on wildfire carbon to get the latest information on this. Not only do these massive fires, with much more to come in the next few years, add carbon dioxide to the air, resulting in more forest fires, the soot is so thick that it creates a darkening hue to the ice, which speeds up melting. We can see the graying world of ice from satellite images, and coal burning isn't helping either. The black soot factor is likely minor, but it all adds up. Meanwhile, Alaska's Senator Ted Stevens told a U.S. Senate committee that the Arctic ice melt is due to increased sunspots. Mr. Stevens must be seeing sunspots in his brain now that he and his son are under investigation for taking bribes from energy companies. But if you read the flamers in various internet news groups, you will still see a whole host of deniers with fatuous reasons why the top of the world is melting away fast, and it has nothing to do with your SUV, so don't worry about that, they say. Let's look at one last scientific theory that could explain the speed of the melt. Jennifer Francis, an associate research professor at Rutgers Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences, said that rising sea surface temperatures are driving the melt. Her paper, along with Elias Hunter, was published in Geophysical Review Letters. They found that sea surface temperatures in the wintertime, not summer, have gone up in the Barents Sea by up to 3 degrees Celsius since 1980. This hotter winter sea surface water could hinder the development of thick ice and thus help a faster melt in the summer. Please note that Francis and Hunter don't think the sea temperature change is just some natural thing. They attribute a warmer sea to greenhouse gases to global climate change. The whole Arctic system is so complicated and so understudied, we can get as complex as you can stand. In 1997, American scientists borrowed a Canadian icebreaker and set it to freeze in the Arctic ice. They wanted to measure ocean currents underneath there. Dr. Robert Pinkle of Scripps Institution of Oceanography led the team, which used Doppler radar bouncing signals off masses of plankton drifting by under the ice, to determine what goes on down there. If you are interested in Arctic oceanography, you can still find a Google video of Pinkle's presentation on May 9, 2005, listed online from UCTV Berkeley. Pinkle's scientists found a bed of relatively warmer water a few hundred feet below the ice. Just under the ice, they found what could be called waves and some mysterious large eddies. Pinkle wondered if something should cause mixing under the ice, bringing up the warmer water held below, then the surface could melt in no time. That seems to coincide with research done by Francis and Hunter. How strange it would be if the force melting the ice was not the obvious unusual hot and sunny weather in the atmosphere, but the residual buildup of carbon-induced heat soaked up by the ocean over decades, finally starting to surface in the Arctic. Likely it is both, hot air and hot water, the perfect storm of latent and current global warming. Now I'd like to play you a few clips from a fine Canadian science program called Quirks and Quarks, hosted by the national broadcaster, the CBC. We find out that even if another super warm summer doesn't happen for another decade, that one hot spot has already done lasting damage to the land-based ecosystems of Canada's north, and likely the same in Siberia. The implications are simply huge.
Coming up, Arctic heat wave. As we mentioned at the top of the program, this year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to Al Gore and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. For the past decade, we've been hearing their predictions on how the planet is going to warm and what that means for the environment. Most of the criticism of these predictions has been that they overestimate the potential problem. But if this last summer is any indication, the situation could be, in some places at least, much worse than anything we'd expected. Take Melville Island, for example. It's in Canada's far north. That's where Dr. Scott Lamoureux spends his summers researching. He's an associate professor of geography at Queen's University in Kingston, and his trip to Melville Island this past summer showed just how warm weather can lead to dramatic changes in the landscape. Dr. Lamoureux, welcome to Quirks.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
For those who aren't familiar with Melville Island, where is it and what's it like there?
Well, Melville Island is a large island located in the Canadian Arctic Archipelago. We consider this area the high Arctic. So it's a tundra area located really quite close to the Arctic Ocean. And it's uninhabited, and it's really an area characterized by a very cold climate. And in the summer, it's typically a cold, foggy, windy place.
What has your team been researching there?
Well, we started this work in 2003, and our primary interest is trying to understand how climate variability is going to impact both the landscape as well as the rivers in this area.
So what was special about this past summer?
Well, it was by the measure of the years we've had there, as well as the instrumental weather record that's available from the Government of Canada, appears to have been really by far the warmest year on record, or summer on record, I should say. And what we would expect in this region, based on the long-term climate record, is something approaching mean July temperatures of 5 degrees Celsius. And what we observed this past July were daily temperatures averaging above 10 degrees Celsius, and daily highs would be between 15 and 20 on about half the days in July. And in some cases, 2 days, we actually exceeded 20 degrees Celsius.
Holy smokes, 20 degrees, and you're saying the average is 5?
Well, that's right. It's really outside of the range of what's been recorded at the weather station since the early 1950s.
What kind of changes have you seen in the landscape because of the warmer weather?
Well, there are a whole host of them, but really the most prominent was associated with degradation of the permafrost. And, of course, this whole region is underlain by permafrost, or permanently frozen ground, much of which is ice-rich. And what we would expect in a normal summer in this area is that the thaw depth during the summer would reach approximately 50 centimeters depth. This year, because of the really warm temperatures, what we observed were thaw depths of over 1 meter total. And the result of that is that there was a considerable amount of ground ice that melted. Now, the water from that ground ice is now at the base of the soil and on top of ice, so it really destabilizes the soil profile. And on even really moderate slopes, this created the situation where we observed quite a large number of extensive detachment slides. These detachment slides are, if you can imagine, they vary quite a bit. But the most common form is actually in the form of a cohesive mat of soil and vegetation, and the roots of the vegetation kind of act to hold it together. And it slides down the side of the hill, often as far as it can go to the bottom of the valley. And in one instance, we observed one that did this over the course of almost 2 kilometers and ended up damming up the river when it reached the bottom over a length of several hundred meters.
What went through your mind when you saw them?
Well, I mean, they're really spectacular to see. Quite often, what you'll see are folds in meadows and other structures like that. You'll see ridges of soil that have been pushed up along several hundred meters. In many instances, you see a clay slurry being ejected from the subsurface onto the soil surface. And in many instances, this would spread out over large areas. And the most spectacular example we saw was actually one that dammed the river and created a large pond upstream of it. And because it had reached the valley bottom, there was really nowhere for this slide to go. So it was piling up in folds that backed up about 30 or 40 meters. And you could, over the course of hours, see these folds growing up upwards of a meter or two.
Wow. It sounds like it's a really dramatic change. What's that do to the local environment?
Well, the impact is actually quite immediate in the water. What we would expect at that time of year, because this is an area dominated by snowmelt, the rivers at that time of year should be really quite low and free of sediment. And what we observed was an immediate increase in the amount of sediment being eroded and transported downstream into the lakes. But we also noticed that the rivers were starting to come up because, of course, these slides, once the water that's being melted out of the ground ice finds its way down to the valley bottoms, contributes to higher discharge. So really we were starting to see a very different kind of river system, and again, that was immediate. The longer-term impact is more difficult to know, but we would expect that these areas will be highly unstable for many years to come and will contribute to erosion and degradation locally, and much of the vegetation that's been heavily disturbed will die out. It's not the only vegetation in the area, but if it It is something that it could cumulatively affect the ability to of this landscape to support the land or the wildlife. Excuse me.
Well, I was going to ask you that. What impact could this have on wildlife and fish?
Well, I think the potential impact is greatest in the aquatic ecosystem. The fish, the Arctic char, which are the only species really present, could be most affected by that. On the land, it's probably less immediate impact because, you know, we're talking about a few percent of the watershed, so there's still abundant, undisturbed vegetation for the various land mammals and other animals.
So overall, then, how serious is this problem?
Well, in the case of where we've been working, this is really totally reshaped the aquatic environment. One summer has done this, and really almost just a week of activity at the end of this summer. So we would imagine, based on what we've observed and what we would expect from this area, that really the aquatic environment has substantially changed for years or perhaps decades to come.
So do you think what you've seen on Melville Island stands as a warning to what could happen in the rest of the Arctic regions?
Well, certainly, just anecdotally, flying to and from the site, I mean, we saw an abundance of these kinds of detachments in the region. But it is a region that, well, we have to be quite careful about where we're thinking in the Arctic. There are many areas with relatively stable landscapes and underlying bedrock that are less vulnerable to this. So Melville Island is kind of representative of the landscape and materials that we'd find really from sort of the Mackenzie Delta across the Arctic islands, the Western Arctic islands, and where we have sedimentary bedrock and abundant marine sediments. And so that represents a large portion of coastal northern Canada.
How concerned are you about this?
Well, I think that it concerns me primarily because I think most of the scientific community was really attuned to the potential for permafrost degradation and these kinds of impacts, but I think that most scientists would agree that there wasn't a sense that this was going to occur at this scale so quickly. I think there was a sense it would be a little more gradual. And there's been a growing body of literature in other parts of the Arctic, for instance, in Svalbard, in North Atlantic Ocean, which is another high Arctic region, suggesting that these sort of episodic, very warm years can trigger long-term impacts. So I'm concerned because even just 1 year may have actually reshaped this landscape and environment in a way that it may not return back to its original state.
So the impacts of climate change are not something for the future. They're here now.
They certainly appear to be. And again, even if we don't see warm summers in the years to come like this, the impact has already been felt.
Dr. Lamoureux, thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, Bob.
Dr. Scott Lamoureux is an associate professor of geography at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario.
That interview by host Bob MacDonald with Dr. Scott Lamoureux was broadcast on October 13, 2007. Quirks and Quarks is one of the best science programs around. Find it at www.cbc.ca/quirks. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and you are listening to our special on the drastic Arctic ice melt in the summer of 2007. So far, we've been talking about the sheet of sea ice that has disappeared over the summer, by far the largest on record. But the ice covering over Greenland is melting at a staggering rate, and that is new water to the ocean, meaning sea levels will certainly rise. According to studies led by Colorado University professor Conrad Steffen, the Greenland melt is accelerating. The 2007 melt broke the previous record, set in 2005, by 10%, making it the largest ever recorded there since satellite measurements began in 1979. You can find this in their December 10, 2007 press release at colorado.edu/news. And we'll be hearing from Conrad Steffen directly in our next segment as he explains the latest science to a congressional committee in late November of this year. This time, there's no questions about ocean currents or wind or other causes. The Greenland ice is melting off due to a simple rise in temperatures, global warming. According to the press release, quote, air temperatures on the Greenland ice sheet have increased by about 7 degrees Fahrenheit since 1991, primarily a result of the buildup of greenhouse gases in Earth's atmosphere. Steffen presented the new research at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco, which was held from December 10th to 14th. Note that he used several U.S. military satellites to measure the ice melt, as well as 22 stations on the ground. Apparently further inland, the snow and ice on Greenland is actually getting thicker at higher elevations, as the greater humidity of a warmer world gets dumped there as snow. But measurements show that Greenland is losing much more ice than it gains in that inland snow. Again, the press release says, quote, "The amount of ice lost by Greenland over the last year is equivalent to 2 times all the ice in the Alps, or a layer of water more than a half mile deep covering Washington, D.C. In the congressional presentation, we'll be hearing about the Jakobshavn Glacier, one of the fastest-moving outlets. For those who Google, that glacier is spelled J-A-C-O-B-S-H-A-V-N. Scientist Stefan also warns that meltwater on the surface is finding its way to the base of the glacier and acting as a lubricant to move the ice much faster to the sea. There is a possibility that huge amounts of ice could break off quickly and simply slide into the ocean. Since Greenland holds about 1/20th of all the world's ice, a total melt there, which would take some time, would raise the sea levels by 21 feet. That's over 6 meters. The University of Colorado team says the spring reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change greatly underestimated sea level projections for the year 2100.
Shit! The whole polar ice cap's melting!
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Join us in the next half hour as we hear some of the latest science. Scientists explain the rapid ice melt to members of the Congressional Committee in late November 2007. We digest the important points from the C-SPAN 2 live broadcast.
There's no escaping the enemy if you and I. We poison up the water, we're choking on the air. Let's stop before it gets too late. Or is it already too late? Is it already too late for the victims of comfort? Got no one else to blame. We're just the victims of comfort, connoisseurs of pain. It's a technological merry-go-round, dangerous solutions buried under the ground. And everyone likes a party, but no one wants to clean. Well, I'd like to see a change somehow, but I'm a little busy right now. Just a little busy right now. I'm just a victim of comfort. I got no one else to blame. I'm just a victim of comfort. Quiet shame. Oh, and what do we got to lose? Everything. Yes, and what do we stand to gain? Everything. So let's try together before we have to cry together. It's too soon to die together. I'm just a victim of comfort. Got no one else to blame. I'm just a victim of comfort. Connoisseur of pain. We're the victims of comfort. Got no one else to blame. I'm just a victim of comfort. Crying shame.
In the summer and fall of 2007, the Arctic ice melted back further than at any time in recorded history. This led scientists to predict that the Arctic Ocean may soon become an open sea. At the same time, startling new science from Greenland showed that surface melt was falling to the bottom of glaciers, lubricating their progress toward the sea. This means a more rapid melt and could lead to dramatic rises in the sea level within your lifetime. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. These changes are so large, their impacts on our climate are still unknown. I want to bring you the latest update on cryology, the study of ice, how global warming is melting it, and what that could mean for our lives and our civilization. This panel of American experts just presented the latest science to a small congressional committee. It was broadcast live on C-SPAN 2 on November 26, 2007. For a limited time, you may still find the video of the broadcast at the C-SPAN 2 website. Meanwhile, I will try to condense an hour-long presentation, bringing out the key points and players. You can download my audio recording of the full presentation at our website, ecoshock.org, from the Climate Downloads area. You will recall there are limitations placed on these agencies on what scientists can say by the Bush administration. Hard facts about climate impacts even on the United States are missing, as are any references to the causes of this disruption of the world's ice systems. The words oil, coal, or even fossil fuels do not appear. One question appears aimed at discrediting outspoken NASA climate scientist James Hansen. Another speaker helps the story along that changing ocean currents rather than a warming climate may be causing the ice melt. Despite all these limitations, the Americans have the best satellites and many excellent scientists who tell this congressional committee and us a lot about recent changes, especially the record summer ice melt and new science on Greenland. We also find out more on the wild underestimation of rising sea levels by the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's not a matter of centimeters we need to worry about, but, as these scientists admit, of meters. Conrad Stefan, the University of Colorado professor of climatology, begins by showing movies taken by cameras dropped down sinkholes in the Greenland glacier. They can see, record, and measure large quantities of meltwater, finding channels all the way down to the bottom of the 1,000-foot glacier. The bedrock below is pushed down 1,000 feet below sea level by the weight of the ice. The meltwater will lubricate the movement of the whole glacier faster towards breaking off in the sea. The meltwater itself comes out into the ocean deep below the surface, unseen. Let's join Conrad Stefan as he describes one glacier, the Jakobshavn, and its rapid changes just in the last 3 years.
Let's look at the Jakobshavn Isbre Glacier. This is one of the fastest moving glaciers we currently have on Earth. It's at 70 degrees northwest side of Greenland. You can see this was the Ice Age 2001, and it was at this place for several decades. This is a floating ice tongue, and here is it's landlocked, and then the ice sheet starts. We have data way back to 1850, Little Ice Age. It was much colder. Through this gate, the ice was flowing in the mid-80s, 90s by about 7 kilometers, roughly 5 miles, into the ocean. The Ice Age retreated up to 2006, and the velocity increased. Last year, the ice moved by about 14 kilometers into the ocean, almost doubled its speed. 2007, I don't have it on the map, retreated further, increased another 10%, 15.5 kilometers per year, close to 10 miles. If you take the ice volume that goes through this gate every day, that moves through and breaks off, it's enough ice for the entire city of New York for 1 year. That's including the industry and all the people living there, just to give you a volume of ice that goes through that region.
Stefan says it is well known that where glaciers come out in such a deep basin or fjord, they start to move much faster. It's called a tidewater glacier. The same thing is happening in Alaska. In Greenland, the fastest melting glaciers are up to 71 degrees latitude. Those further north are also starting to melt at a slower rate so far.
My summary is, we actually see very rapid changes at the margin of the Greenland ice sheet, as well as in Antarctica in the west portion, because they're accelerating and thinning. That means they draw out a lot of ice. No ice sheet model is currently capable of predict that response. If you look at the IPCC report, it showed we have by 2100 about half a meter, 1/3 of feet higher sea level. That's only based on models that show the melt and the precipitation, not the dynamic response that shows the fast flow. So we believe that the IPCC report is underestimating the sea level rise by several magnitudes. The potential of sensitive regions are actually here. West Antarctic currently has about 7 meters of sea level rise because West Antarctica is grounded on the ocean floor. If the ocean water changes, it melts, and the large glaciers of Greenland. Currently, sea level rise from glaciers and ice sheets has increased to 2.2 millimeters. And my last statement is what I just mentioned before. 2100 prediction from IPCC is 0.5 meters. Based on our observation right now, not on a model, we cannot model it yet. We hope to have a model within the next 5 years. We think if it continues to lose ice at that speed that we're currently seeing it, we will have 1 meter or more sea level rise by 2100.
That was Conrad Steffen of the University of Colorado speaking to a congressional committee on November 26, 2007 and recorded by C-SPAN 2. Notice that he predicts twice the sea level rise of the IPCC based just on the current observations. Yet, the ice melts and flows into the sea are seen to be increasing rapidly. The whole system is so unpredictable that no one has developed a model to predict what will really happen. In past geological history, ice sheets have broken apart and disappeared relatively rapidly. We don't know how much the sea will rise, but we do know it will be higher, at least double what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicted in their reports released just in the spring of 2007. Partly for this reason, Conrad Steffen asked the IPCC reports should come out every 3 years instead of every 6 years to include developing science on such a threatening situation. As another spokesperson from NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said, quote, "Things are happening so quickly now, it's hard for the reports to keep up." Then in the question period, Conrad Steffen gave an update of the melt in the Greenland ice sheet.
First, the update for 2007, he asked. We had variability of the melt extent, and 2005 was the largest melt extent we measured from satellite data. 2007 showed a melt area that was 10% larger than the maximum we measured in 2005.
But Steffen cautions that all the data for 2007 is not yet in. They must wait until April to retrieve their equipment that does the field measurements. The next clip discusses a comparison between ice meltage in the 1930s and 40s, when there was a warming period, to the present situation. It begins with a question by Jay Gulledge of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. Mark Cerise of NOAA replies it is difficult to tell due to the lack of data from the 1930s and 40s. There were fewer measurements and, of course, no satellites. But Cerise says, from what they do know, the current sea ice melt now exceeds anything experienced during that last warm-up.
John McCormick with the Energy Policy Center. I want to thank the AMS for these marvelous presentations over the several years, and to the panel as well. But I have to say that the presentations were by and large about melt. The only real impacts that I heard was possible sea level rise. I'd like to think about the world's grain basket in the western half of North America, and also considering that the Amazon rainforests are diminishing. And right in the middle of that is where the world gets the largest part of its grains. China is changing its diet. The United States is using its topsoil to power its cars. Southeast is having a thousand-year drought, perhaps. Australia has lost 60% of its wheat crop. So the question is, when is the scientific community going to approach the National Academy of Sciences and say, study this as hard as you studied the abrupt climate change several years ago, because in my view, this is an abrupt climate change, and the longer we wait, the more we're threatening the world's food availability. Thank you.
Along with Mr. McCormick, we wonder, how do changes in the Arctic ice affect the larger climate system and our food supply? We do get a response from one of our presenters. I believe it's geophysicist Scott Luthke of NASA. Much more study is needed, the scientists say, to find out how ice and sea in the Arctic change the world's climate. Alan Carlin of the EPA asks about predictions by James Hansen of NASA that sea level will rise by 5 meters or 16 feet by the end of this century. Do these scientists agree, he asks. Conrad Steffen, a professor of climatology who studies ice melt in glaciers, replied,
now, Jim Hansen made some forecast that there's a possibility of up to 5 meter sea level rise. I wouldn't say I agree because we cannot really have models currently that predict this. What we do know is that the sea level rise just by melting, surface melting on the Greenland ice sheet, will not contribute more than half a meter, including all the glaciers. But I tried to show that the fast motion of the ice can draw out ice into the ocean. And in Antarctica, these big ice shelves, I have not shown that, but potentially they hold 7 meters of sea level rise, only West Antarctica. What Jim probably postulates is that part of the Antarctic ice shelf is disintegrating, drawing out ice from Antarctica and in Greenland. But let's compare from what we know from the past. During the last interglacial time period, 120,000 years ago, it was 4 degrees warmer. This is about what we expect by 2100 to be the climate, 4 degrees on the average warmer. Sea level was 3 meters higher 120,000 years ago. Part of it came from Greenland. There is evidence that maybe 1, maybe 1.5 meters came from Greenland. And the other part came from Antarctica and possibly from the glaciers. If we take the history from the past and look into the future, having 4 degrees warming, we had 3 meters sea level rise. That gives you the indication we don't really know.
Brad Johnson from hillheat.com asked whether we will lose all the Arctic sea ice by around 2017. He also wants to know if the change in albedo will have a positive feedback effect on the melting of Greenland. Albedo is the ability of a surface to reflect the sun's heat back into space. The white ice has a high albedo, but the darker ocean absorbs much more of the sun's energy than it reflects. Mark Cerise of NOAA answers.
With regard to at least the first part of that question regarding, say, when do you lose that summer sea ice cover, there's a lot of uncertainty there. As I mentioned during my talk, if you look at the projections from the IPCC models, losing that summer sea ice cover may be anywhere from 2050 out to beyond 2100. But it is appearing that we are on the fast track, that we're losing it at a faster rate. We know that natural variability has played a role. But this issue of tipping points that you brought up is key to it. Is the rate of loss linear? In other words, will it be more of a linear loss, or do you drop off the edge? The evidence is strong that it's not linear, that you could drop off an edge. But when could that tipping point occur? We don't know. We simply don't know at this point. If you asked me 5 years ago when we might lose that sea ice cover in summer, you know, I would have said something 2050 out beyond 2100. When I say 2030 now, that's just an educated assessment. However, there are people out there, for example, some of my colleagues from Naval Postgraduate School are saying it could be potentially earlier, maybe as early as 2017. Some of the unknowns in this regards what the ocean is doing. For example, there are pulses of increasingly warm water from the Atlantic coming into the Arctic. This is what we call an Atlantic inflow, and it's becoming warmer. So that's warming the ocean underneath. Now, the problem is that through things like effects of the stability in the upper ocean, it can be difficult to bring that heat up. Okay, if we did bring that heat up to the surface, you could lose the sea ice very quickly. Right now, it doesn't appear that you can. But who knows? This is a wild card in the system. If something should change, this ocean stability should change, we might see a much more rapid loss. There's also effects of changing inflow from the Pacific side that appear to be at work. What is puzzling here is that all these things appear to be conspiring in the same direction, which is a little hard for coincidence. But with regard to when you lose that sea ice, nobody knows.
You are listening to a Radio EcoShock Digest of a presentation on the latest ice science, especially the Greenland ice melt and the Arctic ice sheets melting last summer, presented on C-SPAN 2 on November 26, 2007. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Another wild card, as yet unknown, is the way the lack of sea ice in summer could change temperature, precipitation, and melt speed on the Greenland ice sheet. Conrad Steffen speaks to this relationship between the lack of summer sea ice and Greenland ice on models without a cover of summer sea ice in the Arctic.
And the atmospheric column was actually 8 degrees centigrade warmer during fall and winter if you don't have any sea ice to protect the heat flow from the ocean into the atmosphere. We know that the Arctic Ocean will not be ice-free in winter. Winter will actually still have some sea ice, but there will be a delay because the ocean absorbs, as you mentioned, all the energy throughout the summer once you have that dark surface, because 90% of the solar energy is absorbed by the open ocean, whereas only about 60% or 50% is absorbed once you have an ice cover.
Steffen says there is a direct correlation between the decreasing sea ice cover on the Arctic Sea and the speed and volume of the Greenland ice melt. Another person asks if there is a tipping point at which the Arctic sea ice and the Greenland melt will add so much fresh water that the Gulf Stream system that brings warmth to northern Europe would be shut down. Conrad Steffen replies there is no danger of that happening in the next 100 years. Mark Cerise of NOAA adds that research seems to be showing that the Gulf Stream is not as sensitive as we first thought. There could be a small shift, but the result would not be like the movie The Day After Tomorrow. Rather, it would be an almost protective cooling. That would mean that Northern Europe and the United Kingdom wouldn't get really cold, but it might not heat up as much as other places in the world as global warming develops. All this is still the object of future study. Later, Steffen reports that 2 years ago, for the first time, there was a potato harvest in the Greenland coastal area. This is new, he says, because the Vikings could not survive on Greenland because it was too cold for such crops. One factoid from Steffen, we are currently losing about 100 gigatons of ice or more in Antarctica. He goes on to describe what caused previous ice ages, especially the Milankovitch 100,000-year cycles where the angle of the Earth toward the Sun changes. Answering another question, Steffens points out that megacities with urban sprawl also change the albedo, or reflective power, of the Earth's surface compared to the forests or farmland. But the difference is so small, he says, compared to things like ice sheets, that it isn't a large factor in climate change. Now we will hear from Mike McCracken of the Climate Institute. He will be a future guest on Radio EcoShock as we discuss a new book he has edited on abrupt climate change.
I'm Mike McCracken from the Climate Institute. I have sort of one question or clarification for Conrad and one for Mark. On the this issue of what happened during the Eemian, the last interglacial, my impression is the IPCC said that the global average warming for the Eemian was 1 degree, not 4 degrees. Okay. And that the sea level rise is sort of 4 to 6 meters. And that really gets to this issue of what the climate sea level sensitivity is. Because if you go back to the last glacial, when global average temperature was down 6 degrees or so, sea level was down 120 meters. If you get to the Eemian, which was a pretty short interglacial, you're not sure you're at equilibrium. It was up 4 to 6 meters, maybe a degree warmer. If you go back 20, 40 million years before Antarctica, when it was maybe 4 degrees warmer globally, sea level was up 70 meters. So you might say that the sensitivity to global average temperature is 10, 15, 20 meters per degree, which is, I think, what the concern and rather than quite a small amount. So, but.
Conrad Stefan answers McCracken's first question about temperature in the Eemian period, the last interglacial, along with Mark Ceres.
It's possibly that in Greenland they observed the 4 degree, because I remember the ice core data from Dorothy Dahl-Jensen that was a proxy measurement of the temperature based on isotope 018. And the global might be different, but the local, I'm quite sure, we had 4 degrees, and that's what I refer to Greenland.
I think that is true. If you look at that Eemian, maximum Eemian warmth, globally it was around a degree, okay? But the Arctic was very, very warm at that time. So it really is a big difference in this period between what was happening in the Arctic back then and what was happening globally.
Mike McCracken then asks a second question of Mark Ceres, and his answer explains how sea ice directly impacts the formation of what we now know as normal winters in North America, Northern Europe, and Russia.
Let me ask Mark my question of Mark as well, if I can, which has to do with the Arctic sea ice issues. Showing the September amount of sea ice is very interesting, but it really does. It's a nice indicator, but it doesn't really have much effect about the weather, because the temperature of the surface is at the freezing point, whether there's melting sea ice there or no sea ice there. It's essentially the freezing point. What really matters for the weather for us is when you can form those air masses that are 20 or 30 or 40 degrees below zero, and that takes a meter or so of sea ice to insulate the water from the atmosphere. And so I guess what I'd like to hear something about is the delay in the formation in the fall of thick sea ice, so we can get that very cold air masses that comes down and creates our winter weather and snowstorms and everything else.
Mark Ceres of NOAA answers.
Now, excellent point is made here is that, well, if the loss of September sea ice extent, how could that really impact weather and climate? Because actually the temperature difference between the ocean and the lower atmosphere is actually very small during summer. In other words, the sea ice is melting. Okay? And so the atmosphere above it is kind of fixed close to the freezing point. Not much is happening. Where you're going to expect the biggest effect to occur, at least from my understanding, is probably autumn. Because what is happening here is if we have this greatly reduced ice extent in September, or let's say we have none at some point, well, autumn comes along and the sun sets in the Arctic. It's, of course, 6 months of darkness at the North Pole. But what happens is now, as we come on to autumn, the atmosphere cools. But that means with all that open water, now it's in autumn where you're going to start to have tremendous heat fluxes from the ocean into the atmosphere. These would be fluxes, of course, of sensible heat going up into the atmosphere, but also what we call latent heat. We're going to be throwing moisture up into the atmosphere.
This October, the average temperature over the area of the Arctic, quote,
just a case in point, just as an example, not to say that anything's happening this year, but if we look at these average temperatures for October of this year over the area of the Arctic where we lost that sea ice compared to average, we had temperature anomalies at the surface of roughly 12 to 14 degrees C. Okay, so you can almost double that for Fahrenheit. The reason that happened is because you lost all this sea ice in the summer. Now you had all this open water. The sun sets. The Arctic atmosphere tries to cool. Then you pump all that heat up into the atmosphere. That's the signal that you're seeing. So it's probably going to be a very seasonal effect. And my expectation is it really is autumn is the season to be looking at.
There were a couple more questions. One asked about glacier rebound, the speed at which glaciers can rebuild themselves, possibly due to greater precipitation in the form of snow. The panel scientists say the melt is much greater than the buildup of snow on the interior of Greenland or Antarctica. Both are losing ice mass, according to the new GRACE satellites that can measure changes in gravity and thus the total mass. Another wondered why new instruments, mainly satellites, show a sea level rise of 3 millimeters per year, whereas previous land-based measurements showed only 1.5 to 2 millimeters per year. Was the old measuring system off base, or has climate change increased the speed of sea level rise? The answer appears to be that we don't know yet. Much more science is required. I came away from this video presentation with more information, but missing the larger picture. Why was there only one quick reference to the impact of melting ice sheets and the change in the world weather? Was it because these scientists lacked the expertise, or because the Bush administration had carefully vetted what they were allowed to say, as has so often been the case? For example, the head of the Center for Disease Control had her comments on climate change and disease censored from her report to Congress. Everyone knows which way the wind blows in Washington, so I'm less surprised this group didn't explain the impacts of severe climate change in the Arctic on the American weather and public. The question from the EPA representative seems aimed to discredit James Hansen, who was not there to defend himself. Nor was there any mention of the causes of these dramatic changes. Words like oil and anthropogenic were not mentioned. Neither were the polar bears or the Aboriginal people. It was all exciting science, seen from space or from thousands of years ago, cut off from social purpose. We will have to look elsewhere to find the real meaning of these developments in the cryosphere. And so we end this Radio EcoShock review of the panel before Congress, first broadcast live by C-SPAN 2 on November 26, 2007. If you are hearing this radio broadcast, you can find the printed transcript of it at our podcast site, ecoshock.org/podcast.html. At the same location at ecoshock.org, you can also download the entire one-hour session as presented by C-SPAN 2. I'm Alex Smith. I'm hoping we all learned something from this, and I'm reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Hey, thanks for hanging in with all this cold science about cold places. You want to know what's going on with your world, and that's why we're here each week. We'll go out with some Canadian talent. I grabbed this live performance from the CHLY radio studio in Nanaimo, BC. It's Vancouver Island singer Shane Phillip with Def Mix. And get this, although it sounds like a whole room full of musicians, everything you hear is just Shane with a bunch of instruments all around him, the one-man band, live. Even his feet play music. Join me next week, won't you?
More can I learn to endure one wrong breath?